Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This is First Edition. My guest on this episode is Rachel Kong, whose new novel, Real Americans, was released on April 30th. Real Americans is a family saga covering more than 80 years from the Cultural Revolution in China up until the present day. It's a novel about identity, inheritance, ideas of Americanness, control, connection, and in the end, trying to choose or forge the life you want, even if it might not be the life you thought you wanted or that you were told to want. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I really had a good time. Check out Real Americans. It's a kind of big social novel that has heart and ideas and really gets the pages moving as well. Okay, here we go.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Muse, publisher of Troubled Waters. Troubled Waters is an intimate portrait of two generations, a granddaughter and a grandmother, coming to terms with what it means to be family, Black women, and alive in a world on fire. In heartfelt lyrical prose, Mary Inez Hegler weaves an unforgettable story of the climate crisis, Black resistance, and the enduring power of family. Narrated by Janice Abbott Pratt and written by climate justice writer Mary Inez Hegler, the Troubled Waters audiobook is available everywhere May 7th. It follows Corinne as she plans to stage a dramatic act of resistance and peels back the scabs of her family wounds and puts her safety in jeopardy. Both grandmother and granddaughter must bring their unspoken secrets into light to find a path to healing. Known for her essays that dissect and interrogate the climate crisis, drawing heavily on her personal experience as a Black woman with deep roots in the South, Mary Inez Hegler brings us her first work of fiction titled Troubled Waters. Make sure to pick it up. Thanks again to Harper Muse, publisher of Troubled Waters, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Gallery Books. So Anna Green thought she was marrying Liam West for access to subsidized family housing while at UCLA, which is an interesting reason to marry someone, but you know, in this economy. So anyway, she signed divorce papers when the graduation caps were tossed and she thought she was done. She wasn't. 3 years later, Anna is a starving artist living paycheck to paycheck while West is a Stanford professor. Now he is part of a conglomerate. His family owns this mega grocery store chain. He's not interested in working for them, but he is interested in those greenbacks, honey, that come in the form of a $100 million inheritance. To get it, he has to be married for 5 years. That's where our girl Anna comes back into play. So the two will fake a marriage, but as he gets to know her and gets to appreciate the feisty, foul-mouthed, paint-splattered girl that she is, he'll begin to wonder if the money is worth the love of his life. Pick up The Paradise Problem by Christina Lauren to find out if it is. And thanks again to Gallery Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Sourcebooks Landmark. So King Solomon says something very interesting to his son before he dies, and that is, quote, "Don't let the white man take the house," end quote. These, as I just mentioned, are King Solomon's last words to his son as he dies. Now, all four Solomon siblings must return to North Carolina to save the kingdom, their ancestral home, and 200 acres of land from a development company. Told in alternating viewpoints, Long After We Are Gone by Tara Shelton Harris, is a searing portrait of the power of family and letting go of things that no longer serve you, exploring the burden of familial expectations, the detriment of miscommunication, and the lessons and legacies we pass on to our children. It's an explosive and emotional story of four siblings, each fighting their own personal battle, because who isn't, who return home in the wake of their father's death. Make sure to check out Long After We Are Gone by Tara Shelton Harris. And thanks again to Sourcebooks Landmark for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, Rachel, I've got some questions for you, and some of them are idiosyncratic interests of mine that I hope might be interesting to other people. I moved to New York in August of 2000, and your book begins in, what, 10 months before that, summer 99? I guess not that there's an anecdote that begins that, but our sort of initiating action is summer 99 in New York. Is that right?
I think it's actually closer to the fall. It's closer to right around there would be a holiday party. So
December
99,
yeah. That's so dumb because I was going to ask specific. I was in New York for just 18 months before September 11th. Mm. We didn't know it then, but it was a different kind of New York that wouldn't exist before. So yeah. I was interested in that, but I was especially interested to see later in the book, almost the climax of the book in a way, is also in an office party of a kind. So I thought I would ask you for a minute about what is it about an office? What is the dynamics going on in an office party? Because there's a lot going on here, but in your book especially, we could talk about that. But the idea of the office party is fascinating to me as a scene.
Yeah, I love that you picked up on that. I hadn't even consciously thought of that myself, but I love that you made that connection. I think office parties are interesting because they're so strange. There's this forced cheer in a place that it depends on what you feel about your job, maybe. But I think for the most part, the parties are meant to boost morale and to make
Do they ever work? I remember like, yeah, office party. It doesn't seem like they've ever worked in my experience.
I think maybe for an hour.
And if your boss isn't creepy or something strange doesn't happen.
Exactly. Yeah. But I feel like those are big ifs, right?
Yes.
For the most part, they're pretty awkward because you've seen these people in totally other situation, like where it's more about working. You're often really busy, a lot of anxiety surrounding the workplace, I feel. And so the parties were this like forced situation where you have to, I don't know, have fun in order to be better workers. So I think they've just always fascinated me because they're so artificial.
Yeah.
And they bring together all these people, like so many different people who might not otherwise know each other.
I think that's what in both of your, I think, I don't know if there's another one, the two I'm talking about that sort of bracket the book.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that it's a community of a kind, like all offices or companies are. But then there's like interested strangers of a kind that come into the ecosystem and, for lack of a better term, stir shit up in some way. Not intentionally, but they change the dynamic. And I think one thing about an office party is if you've been working for a company for a while, you get a sense of the dynamics, right? Your routines, your rhythms, the structures, for good or for ill, you know what the power dynamics are. But then you're thrown into this party where you're wearing different clothes. You're not exactly sure what the KPI of a party is. What am I supposed to be doing here? Yeah. And so there's like for something that's supposed to be casual and formal, it actually feels heightened anxiety about what I should be doing.
Yeah. Absolutely. And all of that is so interesting to me, right? First, you bring together all of these different people who normally have this shared task or they have something in common in terms of the work itself. But at a party, I don't know. I think you default to talking about work often at a work party.
Right. Yes.
But it's just such an interesting mix of people. I think the party you picked up on, that's something that's fascinating to me. But also roommates show up in this book a lot because I think that's another situation where you have people, they may or may not have that much in common, but they're sharing this physical space quite intimately. I think for people with full-time jobs, going into an office is often like the most time you spend with other people, right? You might spend more time with your coworkers than you do with your own family. And it's such a strange thing because you get to know them so well, but you also don't know them at all, right? There's so much you don't know about their personal lives.
We still don't even have great language for that. We call them work family. I don't know if people think of that positively anymore. We have work wife, we have coworker, we have colleague, but they don't ever seem to capture. And it can take all forms, too, at the same time. And in both cases of the office parties I'm thinking of, It is also a place of a kind of chaos within a relatively structured environment. People don't know what's going to happen. And that is one thing your book is concerned with as well, is people wanting to try to control destiny, outcomes, happiness, and unwittingly putting themselves in a position where it actually becomes more chaotic and more out of control. And I think an office party is a lot like that. Like a boss, I've put on office parties or happy hours for a company. And I haven't had people fall in love and get married and then realize that they're a virtual clone of someone. Anyway, that's specific maybe to your own book. But as someone who's throwing a party, you have a sense of what you want to have happen.
Yeah.
But at the same time, or maybe you don't even realize that you don't control how these like people are so complicated that even putting four people in a room is too unpredictable to know what's going to happen.
Exactly. I think this book is very much, like you said, about choice, the choices that we make and the outcomes those choices result in our lives, like how choices shape our lives. But at the same time, it's about all of these things that we don't control, right? These things that are outside of our control. And then it turns out life is about that great mix, right? It can't be boiled down to one decision that you made personally or one decision that your parent made. It's this mix of so many different things. And so I think I love that you picked up on, just this chaos of the office party. What can be controlled? You can put out the drinks. You can hope that people find something to talk about. But there's so much responsibility as the party thrower, right? Yeah. You're really hoping that people meet you where you are and drink those drinks and have a good time. Yeah,
it's if you described it this way to someone, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get a bunch of people that are not socially familiar, but they know each other in a work situation. Yeah. We're going to bring all the power dynamics of work. And we're also going to bring a bunch of strangers they don't know, and we're going to get them drunk. And everything's going to be fine. Just expect nothing weird is going to happen. You're going to be super happy the next day. They'll be like, what are you talking about? Are you insane? Exactly. There's no way that's going to work. The opposite, I don't know if it's the opposite of office party. I guess it's not, in real Americans, these aren't like debauched, horrible situations, though they're certainly fraught. Mm-hmm. But I want to, I guess, contrast it with other situations people put themselves, find themselves in, where they're the happiest. Because I think most of the characters here who end up unhappy or end up alone, they also have moments in parts of time in which they are happy for a moment. And I wonder if you could talk for a minute about, is that something you were thinking about when you were putting these characters in position? I'm thinking specifically of, there's a lot of new love here. Like the several couples have a honeymoon period or virtually a honeymoon period where it's just, as Vanna it called it, das Reich des Zwei, like the empire of two, where it's just them under the covers or on walks or going to the movie. I don't think they're doing going, but you know what, like almost like the Nora Ephron-esque like happiness that for reasons of life and choice and stubbornness, they get torn asunder. So that those ones are pretty familiar too. But there's other people that have moments of happiness that they don't allow to exist or gets pulled apart. So I wonder if you could talk about how are you imagining connection? Because that also, that's the opposite of what you're trying to control. And then connection is actually something different in this book.
Yeah, I think connection is very elusive. That's something that I think about a lot, just the fact that we are interacting with people, we're in relationships with people, and the medium that we have to communicate with people is language. Right. And language is so slippery. There's language, there's presence, there's all of these things, but I think that language especially is hard to grasp. You can say one thing and have it be taken in a different way than you meant it. And so I think so often about the ways in which we miss one another. We're not fully understanding one another. And I think that's always been a little bit heartbreaking to me. In my first novel, I wrote mostly about memory and the ways in which memory is so slippery and how between two people who have experienced very similar events or the same events, actually, their memories of those events can be totally different when you can, and we can miss each other in those ways. So I think about that all the time. And this book really is about a lot of misconnections and a lot of language that isn't totally shared between people, whether it's because of culture or a generational difference. There's lots of missing of each other. But I do think that despite that, there can be these moments of incredible connection and these moments where you do feel really connected to somebody or you feel just happy in the moment. Maybe language isn't even involved, in fact. Maybe it's more about just presence and being with somebody else. And so I think this is a book. It's filled with words, of course.
Right.
And words tend to be, yeah, I think we think of words and we think of the mind, right? We think of consciousness and cognition and these very brain-based things. And so that is why the book is the way it is. It's mostly about thoughts, people thinking things, people feeling things. But I think that it was also very important to me to have these moments of like pure happiness where it was almost like the words weren't sufficient. Like, I think the words they put up the scaffolding around the moment, but I think that they're intended for the reader to bring in their own, maybe bring in their own ideas of what that might feel like, what it might mean to be in this, like, this beautiful moment with two people. And I think it is fleeting because maybe I'm a little cynical and the brain always gets in the way, right?
Yeah.
You have a moment of happiness and then you think of something that you forgot to buy from the grocery store or something. There's so
the exegeses of life rear yes. their head and they yeah. feel, sometimes it feels like we're powerless to resist them, even though maybe we could. Cause I think maybe the single happiest group, at least in my reading happens when Lily, who is probably one of our two, three main characters, has a new baby, her mom's in town, and they've also allowed their nanny figure, who also has a new baby, to basically join the, she's being paid and helping, but they're just cohabiting for a while someone is out of town, and they're not really doing much. They don't seem to be talking about anything, really. They're sitting on the couch, I think, watching, was it Chinese soap operas?
Which is...
not material, right? It's not, it's just something to be together with. And I think Lily maybe even expresses that she doesn't remember being this happy or something to that nature. And then what happens is a husband comes home and that kind of breaks it down because it's not a tenable. This is not a familiar domestic arrangement that doesn't seem sustainable, the economics of it, the culture of it. And it's also, it could be, but it just also we understand that it isn't, which is very weird to say.
Yeah, it's so fleeting. That's one of my favorite moments, I think, for Lily, because she really goes through a lot. I guess I put her through a lot, but I think that is just such a moment of respite for her, even though she doesn't understand the language.
Or could articulate what she likes about it, I don't think, actually.
Yeah, but I think it's really just about this closeness. There's physical proximity. There's this intimacy. We were talking about the workplace and about roommates and the shared intimacies there. I think sometimes these small communities of people are created and you can't really predict how that's going to happen.
It's alchemy.
It's a little bit of magic. And I think that moment is, it's just so special for her. And I'm, I feel happy for her when I think about
it. And there's something too about having, I remember experience not unlike this when my kids were new. There is a clarity of purpose for anyone that's in the situation and it strips away a lot of the bullshit, right? Let it go. Let the sink get dirty. We don't have to go to the party. It does de facto strip away a lot of the things that we allow to get in the way. So in that way, it makes sense, but it's also fleeting because the baby grows up.
Yeah.
Mom's got to fly back. Maternity leave is up.
Yeah.
And what's funny is as they're fleeting, the temptation then, of course, okay, how can I hold on to this? But then your book also is wary of that idea of let's hold on, let's control.
Yes.
To the genetic level even, what can I do to protect, maintain, guarantee happiness? So that feels very much intentional. Like it's alchemy, which I guess is a pseudoscience of turning raw materials into gold, compared with very real or near future kind of science exists here that I think a lot of us that are paying attention to genetic manipulation and CRISPRs are like, what is the end point?
It's like, exactly.
That's very appealing. And yet we also know that the roommates, the four roommates that get together, that's not genetic. That's not something that science understands. That's personality. Isn't these characters here are near clones of each other, very carefully manicured. And yet they're less, these people are less successful at cultivating their kids' happiness than anyone I know, or at least no more successful.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's human, obviously, to want to control.
Yes, it totally makes sense. Yeah.
Because we both want surprise, but we really don't want surprise, I think, in our everyday lives.
Not when it comes to our kids' lives, at least I'll speak for myself here.
Yeah. I think it's, you want the best for the people that you love. But I think that you don't necessarily know what the best is because you are so limited in terms of your own
and you're different from
perspective
them.
And you're different from them. Yeah. And I think that is part of this, the project of this book is it's in the perspectives of these three different characters who live at completely different times, who have these different cultures because they're steeped in different, they have different relationships. They have different genders. It's about the differences between these people who they might be proximate to each other. They might see one another every day, but they still don't know each other fully because they haven't experienced the other person's life, really. And I think a novel is so interesting because for me personally, that's how I sort of like just like lower myself into another consciousness. It's a really, I think that it's one of the best ways that we have for experiencing another human brain, what it's like to be another human being, not just the brain, but also the body, what it's like to experience the world in a totally different body. And I think that's what I love about books. But I knew with this book, it couldn't just be one person because part of the project of the book was to say, okay, that one person is so limited. What about this other person? And how do those lives intersect really and form one another? I think we are so formed by the people that we meet. We're formed in ways that are super obvious. We get married to someone, we have a child, whatever that is. Those are really significant human encounters. But there's also those much smaller ones, the ones like the office parties.
What job you happen to get, who is your boss at your internship, all that kind of stuff.
Those all shape who you become. Not that it's like you become somebody and then you're just that one person, but I think there's so many little things, so many encounters, so many people that just shape who we are. And that has always been so interesting to me, especially this book is called Real Americans. It's so much about American ideas and American myths, really. And one of those American myths is that we're self-made, right? Yeah. That we're individuals, that we can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. But I think it's just the opposite of true. We're obviously so formed by the people around us and we're so shaped by so many factors. And I think it would do us well to just pay more attention to that.
Yeah, I wish I would have marked it. When I was reading it, I was like, I should underline this and I didn't have a pen and I didn't. But you do talk for a moment. And I guess this is sort of a way of reconciling the two poles. One of throwing up your hand saying everything's random, things are going to, don't even try, versus let's genetically engineer ourselves and our kids within an inch of their hair color, eye color, whatever. Right. Neither of those, right? So we're left with I don't want to spoil the end of the book because I think there's some gestures made towards the end of the book that are a way of reconciling that. But can you talk for a little bit about, okay, if those don't, if it doesn't work, just to be like, whatever's going to be, I have no control. Yes. I'm going to subject myself to the universe and whatever, versus I'm a billionaire and I can do whatever.
Yeah.
We have to choose a way to be in the world, right? In either case. So what do these characters wrestle with? What are they trying to figure out in that regard?
I think it's such a good point. It's the two poles, right? The two extremes are, one is just throwing up your hands and giving up and being perhaps really depressed and feeling that you have no agency over.
And we have
life.
Characters that do that, I should say. We have some examples of characters that do give up in the most extreme way.
Yes. And then there's the other end of it where you believe that you have power, that you have complete control over your life. And maybe it is because you have a ton of money and you can, for the most part, or for in many regards, you can shape the world around you. You have power over other human beings. Like I think, and we see both of those extremes, I think, in this country, especially. But I think there just has to be something in the middle
or a third space. If it's not in the middle, it's somewhere else.
Maybe it's somewhere else. I think it's where there is a feeling of that you do have agency over your own life. Maybe you've been dealt some cards. Some are better than others. You've just been dealt the hand that you've been dealt. And with that, what do you do? Like, how do you relate to other people? How do you exist in the world? There's also this sort of thread of throughout the book of like political action, really, right? There are these huge movements. One of the characters lives through the Cultural Revolution. There's not much that she can do about that. There's not much she can do about the fact that is happening, but she can take her own action. She can make decisions for herself in her own life And she does stage this small protest, which is how the book begins. Mm. She hides some relics that the Red Guards were otherwise going to destroy. And so that's her small act of protest. And so I think there are ways we can protest as individuals. Yeah. There are ways that we can, just put our foot down or just say, no, not on my watch. There are things that we can do. And of course, there are whole systems that don't really don't care what we do and that we're helpless in the face of. But I don't think that means that we can just give up.
Right. Yeah. And in the way that you use what power you have in some kind of way, there's people here with tremendous power, I guess, from Mao being the most powerful figure that figures. And then the titans of, I guess it's technically Western capitalism because they're German company that comes, various like titans of geopolitics, world making kinds of figures.
Sure.
All the way down to my best friend.
Yes.
And trying to figure out how they can be and not be in relationship to each other. And one of the things I was thinking about is the title, and it's very much about Americanness, but also what virtues do these characters not possess that Americans don't possess? To suggest to be an American for good or for ill is one thing. Its opposite also means something. And the thing that I kept coming back to is humility quite a few times. Not a lot of humility on display until the end in some cases. And I guess maybe that's a third way of thinking about, okay, maybe you have to say, I got to make some choices. I got to try to shape my life in some way. But I also have to understand, I don't know everything. I don't know what's best with my son. I don't know what's best for the world. I don't know what's best with Greater China. I don't know what's best to do with sparrows, because that goes super well.
Yes.
And maybe a tincture or an alloy with a little humility would be helpful there along the
way. I love it. Yeah, that word is something that has been on my mind really as I'm thinking about, what is this book really about? It's not a glamorous thing to say that it's about humility, but in a way it is, because it's really about so many people who think that they know best for somebody else. And again, like you said, there's these gradations of power, right? You might just have power over the person who loves you, or you might have power over whole countries.
Right.
Yeah, just huge swaths of people. But regardless, I think it benefits us if there's just more humility about what we really don't know, because we're so limited in our human perspectives.
I was even trying to check that myself a little bit, because I have to admit, I found myself getting a little frustrated at the beginning with, okay, I'm going to get names right, with Lily, right? She's in New York, she's aimless, she's letting life happen to her. And then Nico does something a little bit similar later. He's in a similar position. And I found myself saying, get your shit together, just pick something and go. I was trying to read it the opposite way. They're not they don't know what they want, which can be annoying to an older person like me at this point. If you're so young, the world's your oyster. I guess oysters also appear weirdly. I think about that. But in a way, they weren't forcing it, I guess. They weren't depressed. They weren't, maybe Nico was a little bit better than I do, but they certainly weren't trying to force a narrative, even of their own making, onto their lives. They were just letting something happen. And then something great happened to both of them. I don't know. I didn't know what to make of that.
Yeah, that's so wonderful that you brought that up. I think that I didn't know at the time, but I was really writing three coming of age stories. Each of these characters experiences a coming of age. Again, not that they're fully fledged or whatever by the end of these processes, but it's really, are we ever? But it's really about, because it's so much a book about how you become who you become, I think that period of life just came to the fore because it's such a formative time, I think, for many people. And I was thinking about this earlier today. It's such a formative time, but living through it is not necessarily so fun. For me personally, I think I can romanticize it in retrospect, but living through it, I was not having a great time. I think I felt aimless. I didn't know quite what I was going to do. I did know that I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't have the skill yet to actually accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this added pressure of knowing that you're young and having people tell you, enjoy this time, you're so young.
That's right.
You're like, I don't know, I'm trying to. I have no idea what I'm doing.
Right.
And so I think that I wanted, of course, it's a book. There are things that happen. It's not so aimless as my personal 20s. But I think that I wanted to capture that, some of that. While it is both a narrative, it's a narrative, but it's also, I hope, capturing some of the messiness around that too, right? It's not just this like point A to point B. He started out this way and then he discovered this amazing,
right.
Like it's not a superhero.
A Bildungsroman where we have
yeah.
a fully fledged hero or a character that's identifiable yeah. and stable forever and ever. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not like this origin story for someone who becomes a superhero. It's more about, it's just this like messy in between phase that many of us go through. And I think in retrospect it's easier to make a narrative out of it, right? It's easier to say, okay, I can see how I became who I became based on what happened during this time. But in the moment when you're living it, it's not apparent. You're like, I have no idea how this is going to turn out for me.
Well, I think and this time can be especially fraught. I've thought about it in this way, which is at some point, I guess, if someone ever, character or real person, gets to a point of like, is this what I really want? That's their coming of age. It can happen at 11.
Yeah.
It can happen at 80.
Oh, definitely.
And I think you do have characters at different stages of life saying, is this really what I want? Whether it's Matthew, who the scion of the mayor company, having it a little bit later. Probably Nico having it earlier, maybe. I'm not really sure. Lily having it quite a bit later. May having it quite a bit later. Some of it is about opportunity. Some of it is worldview. Some of it is personality. But at some point, your coming of age is when you say, damn, is this really what I really want? I think it's even after doing the thing you thought you wanted. Because that's another thing. You thought you wanted to be a scientist. You thought you wanted to be what did Lily want to be? She was an art history. She wanted to be a writer, but she didn't have the skills. Oh, that may have been you or some version.
That's me. She wanted to be an architect, but she
architect.
Didn't have the skills.
Skills. Anyway, that same kind of dynamic of wanting.
Yeah.
But then I'm going to do something else. But it's once you get over that thing that is prescribed for you.
Yes,
I guess with May, it's earlier because she decides to go to sit for the exam. Maybe that was her moment. If I want something
it's
other
also,
than this.
Yeah, it's also just not. It's not just one moment.
Right. Not just a very fair point.
Right. I think it happens throughout life. And I think it's those moments that make us, right? Mm-hmm. These turning points. And May, I think, has a few.
Right.
She knows pretty early on that she doesn't want to stay in this village forever. She wants something bigger. But I think much later, she realizes that bigger thing that she wanted maybe was misguided, right? Maybe she actually wanted something much simpler.
Yeah.
And I think she also looks back on that moment where Nico was just born and they're all together having this beautiful time together that's, sleep deprived, just present. And I think she realizes, I was so ambitious for so many things. I wanted the world, but really what I wanted was just intimacy. And I just wanted to be with my daughter. And it's only much later that she realizes that. And that's like another turning point for her.
Yeah. I want to ask a couple of things about the writing of the book and just because I'm personally quite curious.
Yeah.
Is there a part that you can think of that was, what was the most stable from inception to end? What was the thing that was there the whole time and didn't change a whole lot or the least changeable?
Yeah, I write in this really weird way where I often know the beginning and I know the end.
Okay.
And the middle is
the
just
middle, the messy middle. Yeah, I'm gonna pick it up the middle.
But the voices of each character were very clear to me. And I think that the beginnings of each part, each character's narration, so Lily at the holiday party, Nick in the parking lot with his friend Timothy, May being a creep around San Francisco. Those voices and those scenes all came to me quite early in this drafting process. And I just knew that this is what the characters sounded like. This is where they were.
Even before their relationship to each other, the plot mechanics?
I knew their relationships. I knew who they were to each other, but I didn't know a lot of the details.
Okay.
I really didn't know a lot of the details. But I just knew, you mentioned 1999, 2000. For some reason, Lily was just, that was where she was. I could picture the bucket hats and the, I could picture the Y2K fashion. And I could picture that Kmart parking lot where Nick and Timothy were. I could picture all of that. But it was such a struggle to figure out everything else that happened in each of their lives. And I think the writing process was just a lot of working day after day. It was drafting a lot of scenes, many more scenes than actually appear in the book. I probably have 50,000 words, honestly, on the cutting room floor. There's so much, because that's part of how I get to know the characters. Getting to know the characters is a lot like getting to know people. I don't really know who they are at the beginning. I just had a sense of their voice, but I think I put them into a lot of different situations so that I could better understand who they were as people. And so ultimately, the reader doesn't need to know all of that, but I, as the writer, had to write all of that to just figure that out and to see, yeah, if I had put them in those situations, how might they react if I put them in the ones that are actually going to make it into the book. And yeah, so that's what I had. I had the voices. I had a sense of the feeling that I wanted. I know that's weird to say, but I just knew that at the end, I knew what feeling I wanted to elicit from maybe myself, but also a reader. Just this feeling that, like, that you had gone on this journey, what had been like a little bit epic, but you had a sort of, but it was also like, it was both like epic and very intimate. I think that was the feeling that I was trying to capture. And writing is very mysterious to me. I think I'm always surprised by it. I think it's, we were talking about surprise earlier and how we both like and don't like to be surprised, right?
So what was the biggest surprise then? Out of the messy middle that emerged, I don't want to discredit the agency of the author in front of me, but
what
was the most thing that you're like, wow, I wasn't expecting this to make it into the, this to be a part of the book in some way?
Here's one thing. The all the characters experience this strange time blip.
I was going to ask about that. I wondered where that, how that came down the track.
Yeah. Again, I wrote the characters, they came to me in the moments that they appear in the book. And the time blip is on after the prologue. It's like page one of Lily's section. And that's the first page I ever wrote. I knew that it was, I knew that something weird was happening with time, but I didn't understand what it was. And that's an example of just, I was in complete darkness about it. I knew that all of these characters were experiencing these strange blips, but I didn't know why. And actually early on, I didn't even know, I knew that the book was about science because one of the characters seemed to want to be a scientist. I didn't know if it was about physics or biology, to be quite honest.
I guess biology is a little more human scale.
Yeah, biology is more human scale, but physics, that involves time. That could have been a reason.
And control and determinacy. Exactly. You can see it going in those kinds of ways. Yeah.
But I don't know. So the thing that surprised me was a few years into it, I realized that the blips, I don't think this is a spoiler, the blips are actually, they're not science at all. They're magic. And when I just had that thought, I think when it came to me also almost like magic, I thought, oh no, I can't have this
book. Why, oh no?
I thought I can't have this book have magic and it has much in it. I was
It's spec fic now, Rachel. It's spec fic. That's what we call it.
It is now. I know, but I think in the moment I was like, I just picture me in the bowels of this book. There was so much. It was so unwieldy. I didn't know when I would finish it, how many more years it would take.
Did it feel like a deus ex machina to you? It's like a cheat, or is that why you didn't like it?
It was a cheat, but it was more like I thought that I could figure out the scientific reason for it.
Oh,
and I actually I looked a lot into scientific, just the different ways in which people perceive time, like the circadian rhythm, just like our sort of internal clocks. I was really looking into a lot of that and the biology of that. But then when I realized it was magic, I thought this actually makes so much sense to me, because I think this book is so much about control and what we can control. And there's a way in which, because like, I think science, we think of science and we think, oh, we can understand things. We can do these experiments. We can understand the laws of physics. We can understand how to edit genes. We can understand all of these things. And we have this impression of power, of control, of understanding of the world. And I think the magic, again, it's about humility, right? It reminds us we don't know everything. There's so much about the universe we don't understand. We don't even know what's out there, really. Right. There's so much technology.
Dark matter, it's yada, yada, yada the equations. Dark matter, it all looks fine. We just have dark matter. We don't know what it is, how much of it is, but it makes everything make sense.
Exactly. All the dark matter stuff, you're like, okay, we really don't know.
We still don't know.
We really don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so I think just that was another way in which I was just, bringing up the humility in that respect. Like, we don't know. We like to think we know everything because it feels better. It feels really good to think that we know everything, or to
or
think
even that it's knowable. I may not know, but at least it's knowable. Yeah. Someone knows.
What like we love predicting. We love like observing that if this happens, then this will happen. This will follow. But I think the reality about our lives really is that unexpected things happen all the time. Terrible tragedies, but also these amazing surprises. And we just forget that sometimes, I think, in the mundanity of the day-to-day, right? We think, okay, scientists are figuring stuff out and my life is just what it looks like. And I'm going to these holiday parties and my office. And but the reality is like our lives are so mysterious. And also it's like amazing that we're here. It's
yes,
like
I marked the page when you, aren't we lucky to be here at this time and this place?
Yeah.
And I really respond. Yeah, I was wrestling with how to take the slip. Is he called the time slips? I'm not even sure.
Yeah, I think I was using different words for
different
them.
Words.
They could be called whatever, blips or anything. Yeah.
Yeah. And the characters, they can manipulate it to some degree. Some of them can manipulate it to different degrees. Mm-hmm. I think the thing I took is they don't understand their own being, right? There's this thing that's going with them that they don't understand. They have to figure out how to come to terms with. Use it,
yes.
Ignore it, whatever, which I think is not non-metaphorical for our own existence.
Sure.
I don't even understand myself to some degree.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then also, even with a quasi-superpower, they don't figure things out. Even Nico uses it to study more, but it doesn't make him happier.
Oh.
To me, it felt even if you had mastery over time and space,
yes.
That still wouldn't be enough just for everything to work out all the time.
It's this hypothetical that I think about all the time, right? If I had all the time in the world, if I could have, if I didn't have all my other responsibilities, if I could have just, I don't know, worked on this book all the time. I don't know. I think that a lot of powerful, rich people do have more, quote unquote, more time. I always think about that. There's that mug that says something like, we all have 24 hours, like Beyonce.
Right.
And I always think that's not exactly
true. It's not true.
Beyonce has a lot of staff and she has people working for her and she gets to decide what she does with all of her time. Whereas
I have a washing machine. People don't have washing machines, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes,
we don't all have 24 hours.
We don't all have 24 hours. People's time is accounted for, honestly, often by what they need to make a living. We need to live under capitalism. And I think there, especially when you are time strapped, when you feel like you don't have enough time for yourself to be doing the things that you want to do. There's this, there's almost a fantasy. What if I had all the time in the world?
Better looking or all the things that you could have. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think some of these characters do embody those hypotheticals and they have so much money. They have beauty. They have all of these things, but there is, despite all that, that's not where peace comes from, right? That's not where like contentment comes from. And I think all of the characters experience, like you said, they experience this time blip. They all interact with it in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
They even value it in different ways because I think all of their approaches to time are so different. Like I think for May, it's something that she wishes because she doesn't feel that she has enough of it. She feels like time has been taken from her by her circumstances. And that's all true. And so she really values time. She feels pressed for it. But someone like Lily, who is in a more comfortable situation, who's led a more middle-class life, she just wants to use this power to spend time with the people she loves. It's other priority.
Right.
And she doesn't think of it as this utilitarian thing or this way to get ahead. It's not about ambition for her because she's not really an ambitious person. She's someone who cares more about the present moment, maybe, instead of the future.
Yeah. And I mean, as a way of thinking about resource, right? Whether it's money, power, prestige, it's how it's used, but also that no matter how much resource you have, it certainly can help in a lot of ways, but it still might not be enough for you to fucking forgive your mom.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
It may not be enough for you to do the thing that's preventing you from doing the thing that will actually help you connect with other people. There's no amount of money that lets you say exactly the right thing to the person that needs to hear, or even understand what they need at the moment. That's beyond the scope of utilitarian algebra. It's not a function of something else.
And in fact, you might have so much money that it makes it harder to do those things.
That's right. That's all. It gets in the way and the clouds. That Samuel, the most tragic character, probably is probably the closest exemplar of being so far away from being in connection with other people that he's unmoored, right?
It's like that. But he has every material advantage. He's what people wish that they had, just money and education. He's what May wishes that she had growing up. And what might she have done if she had all of the resources that he had?
Today's episode is brought to you by Underlined. Haven't read a Natasha Preston thriller yet? We dare you to try. She's known for her line of chilling young adult suspense novels like The Cellar and The Fear. The New York Times and USA Today bestselling author excels at putting fear into the hearts of her readers. So her newest book, titled The Dare, is about five friends whose senior prank goes very, very wrong. This is the perfect graduation season read for thriller fans who can handle a good scare. The Dare is now available wherever books are sold. You can learn more about it at getunderlined.com. So again, this young adult thriller is about five friends with a prank that goes wrong. There are dark secrets, a twisty plot, and creepy I Know What You Did Last Summer vibes. So if you know, it's graduation season, you want to revel in that, but like make it scary, you know what I mean? Pick up The Dare by Natasha Preston, and thanks again to Underline for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Penguin Team. In a world where the children of the gods inherit their powers, a descendant of the Greek Fates must solve a series of impossible murders to save her sisters, her soulmate, and her city. Descendants of the Fates are always born in threes. There's one to weave, one to draw, and one to cut the threads that connect people to the things they love and to life itself. And the Aura sisters are no exception. There is Io, the youngest, who uses her Fate-born abilities as a private investigator, but her latest job leads her to a horrific discovery. Somebody is abducting women and setting the results wraiths loose in the city to kill. Now, the second book in the series, Hearts That Cut, will be on sale June 18th, 2024. This is a must read for all Greek mythology and fantasy fans. This is dripping with atmosphere, edged with danger. Threads That Bind weaves together a gorgeous dark tapestry of mystery, faded romance, and modern myth. You won't be able to put this one down. And that comes from Alexandra Bracken, New York Times bestselling author of Lore. So make sure to pick up Threads That Bind by Kitsa Hatsopoulou. And thanks again to Penguin Teen for sponsoring this episode.
Last one, I'll get you out on this. And I might just cut it there. That was a pretty nice cut point. So we'll see. That was beautiful what you said at the end. I've asked this question sometimes, and sometimes I get nothing, which is fine. And sometimes I get the most exquisite shit. So I'll ask it here. Was there a note or a comment or someone's observation of a draft or an idea or a scene that stuck with you for good or for, that really changed or that illuminated something for you, or that you were like, oh, I didn't see it that way, or that really mattered to you?
Yeah, I might give you shit instead of exquisite shit.
That's okay. That's all right.
But I think that even what you said about, I think everyone is, it's so interesting what people want to talk about and bring to me. And even the fact that you brought up those parties, those office
that's
parties.
I was like, this is going to be so dumb. I shouldn't even say it, but I couldn't help it.
No, I loved it. Yeah, I really had not made that connection that there are these two important scenes that happen at those parties. And I think that's something that I gravitated to.
It's your pre-pub too. The book is not really out in the world yet.
I'm sure
with Goodbye Vitamin, you had all sorts of people say stuff like, whoa, I was not expecting that to come out.
I think the thing that surprises me most is, I don't know, books are, they're so personal. They're, because they contain so much, they contain so many years of a writer's life. And also they're being co-created by a reader. Reader is bringing their own experience to it and imagining the characters. They're bringing the characters to life. Like we said, they're bringing their own moments of happiness to these transcendent moments that they're reading about on the page. That each experience is so specific and so singular. Like each reader's experience of the book is, it's never existed before. Like that's its own experience, right?
Well, it's ironic, right? Because it is a code of its own kind. The texts are, the words on the page are irrefutable. You're not going to argue that, but the epigenetic expression of that text for any given reader is so manifold that it's beyond control or prognostication in a way.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I think that's the surprising part to me. And the fact that for so many things in our world today, We live in such a tech mediated world, and everyone is trying to get our attention, our money. There's so many algorithms recommending us things to do, to watch, whatever. And they're breaking us down into these facts about ourselves, like our demographic, how old we are, what race we are,
what
our
Hogwarts
gender.
House we are, what Enneagram wing we are. It extends into all sorts of stuff.
Which Disney character are you?
Which Disney princess are you?
But a book really defies that, because you can't predict who is going to like a book. I can't give it to someone in the exact same demographic as me and expect them to like it. That's just not the way that it works.
And publishing's been trying since time immemorial to do that, and it's escaped everyone's ability.
And I think that obviously frustrates the powers that be. It frustrates the capitalists, but I feel that's the thing that is so beautiful about novels.
As someone who's not obsessed with the control, that's maybe easier for you. That's not something you're like, that I have a message that I need to communicate and somehow I failed in my mission here. That's not seem to be what you're not trading in that kind of goal.
No, I do like control, but I think with fiction, it's art, and it's more about asking the questions. I don't think I don't have the answers. And I think that if it raises questions for people, that's all I'm hoping for.
Thanks so much to Rachel Kong for taking the time to talk with us today. That was one of my favorite conversations I've had with an author in a while. Real Americans is out now, worth your time. I also saw recently too that her debut novel that launched her career, which is excellent, called Goodbye Vitamin, is only a few bucks on ebook retailers, so you can pick that up as well. Stick around. Coming up this month, we've got some more great author interviews, books I've talked about on the Book Riot podcast, authors I've followed for a long time. So I hope you will stay tuned. If you want to share the show with people, that's the best way for people to find out about the show. If you want to rate it on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, that really helps us find new listeners. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, read something great.